We're continuing our series on 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We're up to verse 5. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 5. And let me start just by reading the 11 verses here in the middle of chapter 3, starting at verse 5 and ending at verse 15. What, therefore, is Apollos? And what is Paul? They are servants to whom you believed, even to each as the Lord gave. As for me, I planted. Apollos, he watered. But God was increasing. Thus, neither the planter nor the water is anything, but rather it's the increaser, it's God. Now the planter and the waterer are unified, although each will receive his own reward according to his own labor, for we are God's co-workers. You are God's field, God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me as a wise architect, I laid a foundation, and another is building upon it. But let each look to how he is building upon it. For no one is able to lay another foundation besides the one which is being laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds up gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or straw upon the foundation, the work of each will become apparent. For the day will show that by fire is revealed. And the fire will test the work of each one as to what quality it is. If the work of someone remains, which he has built up, he'll receive a reward. If the work of someone gets burned down, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet as through fire. David Livingstone, the pioneer missionary to Africa, once said, "I place no value on anything I have or may possess, except in relation to the kingdom of Christ. If anything will advance the interests of his kingdom, it shall be given away or kept, only as by giving or keeping it shall most promote the glory of him to whom I owe all my hopes in time and eternity." That's an excellent watch phrase of this missionary to Africa, who basically brought the needs of Africa, as well as the geographical information about Africa, to the Christian world so that Africa could be evangelized. He is an example of a Christian leader who can be imitated and who could be idolized by some people. We're looking at, in the context of 1 Corinthians here, Paul is addressing a problem of factions, divisions in the church. Why are there these people that say, "I'm of Paul"? Some people say, I'm of the Apollos group, and other people say, "I'm of the Christian group," and they're all fighting against each other. And Paul identifies two reasons for the split off that have been occurring. One of them he's addressed in the first two chapters. It's that they've misunderstood the nature of the gospel. Instead of focusing on the power of the cross of Jesus and salvation, forgiveness through Jesus Christ and the work he did on the cross, instead of focusing on the power of the cross, they were focusing on the power of human wisdom to organize groups and to impress people with human wisdom. So they misunderstood the nature of the gospel by focusing on human wisdom rather than the power of the cross of Jesus. And when that focus was misplaced, it suddenly became a focus on people and what people could do, and that naturally led to focuses on different people and splitting up according to the leadership of different people. There's a second issue that is causing these rifts in the church, and that is a misunderstanding concerning what Christian leadership is all about. Paul begins to address this issue of Christian leadership in chapter 3. They misunderstood the nature of Christian leadership. It's all about God. It's not all about the human leaders. I'm gonna try to break this into 3 points. The first point is it's not about the leaders. And the second point is it's all about God. And then the third point is it's also about how you lead. So the first point is not about the leaders. The purpose of ministry, leadership in ministry, is not to win followers or make a name for yourself. The purpose of Christian leadership is to bring people to faith in Jesus so that they will follow Him. A Christian leader is not a servant, is not organizing things for his purposes, or should not. Far too many of them do that, but they shouldn't be organizing things for their purposes. A Christian leader should organize people to fulfill God's purposes. When we lavish praise upon Christian leaders, we are robbing God of glory. There are many examples that could probably be drawn from this. I remember one time when I was traveling in Florida, stayed at the home of a precious African American couple, and noticed on their wall they had a picture of Jesus, and right next to the picture of Jesus was a picture of Martin Luther King. That kind of made me uncomfortable to see a man raised up to the same status on their wall as Jesus. But plenty of my friends that weren't African American did similar things with their pictures of Christian rock stars that they hung on their bedroom walls. We do this. All kinds of Christian leaders, cult leaders, have taken people away by making them follow them as a person and removing them from the rest from the Bible and from the rest of Christianity. One example I can think of recently was a college friend that started listening to a radio program where the teacher's name was Harold Camping. I think the radio program is called Family Radio. And this radio preacher was teaching that all of the churches are apostate, and that these are the end times, Jesus is coming back anytime now, and that if you're a true Christian, you need to pull out of your church and only listen to his radio program. And my friend began following this guy's teachings, and he's still doing it today. That's a very typical thing with cult leaders. Jehovah's Witnesses started out that way too. People, leaders, charismatic leaders, predicting the return of Christ soon and gathering a bunch of followers and then moving them away from the rest of Christianity, away from the Bible. We do it even in our own circles. I have seen plenty of people that are Vision Forum groupies that measure our acceptability by how many Doug Phillips catchphrases we use, or other people, whoever it is that you're prone to follow, R.C. Sproul catchphrases or Francis Schaeffer catchphrases. You know that person's okay because he's speaking my language. Paul destroys these leadership stereotypes in verse 5. He says, "Me and Apollos, we're not masters, we're not leaders, we're not bishops, we are what? Servants." Paul isn't going to play into this thing of allowing himself to be built up as a leader. He said, "We are servants through whom the Lord is doing what he wants." He says that in verse 5 also that any followers that have happened to follow him or Apollos were not earned by them, but were rather given by God. Faith is a gift. We saw that in Ephesians 2. "For in grace you are in the condition of having been saved through faith. And this gift is God's. It is not from you." God does the saving, not man. Even in the Old Testament, David recognized that. He said, "Blessed is the one who has been chosen and has been brought near. He will dwell in your courts." It's not that I chose God and I came near to God, it, David says in Psalm 65, verse 4, it was God chose me and God brought me near, and that's why I'm with him. I'd like Timmy, is Timmy here? And Peter to come forward. I have them pegged as the two most likely to become evangelists in this church. They love meeting new people and making new friends. I'm going to give them each a half a roll of nickels, and I'm going to ask you guys to distribute these nickels to, I think there's probably enough for everybody here. Just hand them out, give one to everybody. You can keep one for yourself, but just kind of quickly hand those things out. If the followers of Paul and Apollos in Corinth were converted by God's Spirit and allocated by God to be taught by Paul and Apollos, those followers have no business exalting one leader over another. They have no business dividing into competing groups because they both came from the same God and their ultimate allegiance is to that same God. So my question is, everybody that's received a nickel, who are you going to thank for that nickel? Who gave it to you? You better not thank Peter and Timmy because they weren't your nickels. They're my nickels. You better thank me, all right? You don't thank them. Why? Because they weren't their nickels in the first place. They were my nickels. And so if you're going to thank somebody, you thank the giver. And that's Paul's point here. You can keep your nickels. Okay, I'll keep the extras. Don't spend it all in one place, though. The point here is that if God gave followers to Paul and to Apollos, then the followers should not be raising their leader, Paul or Apollos, to some position of praise and honor. They can merely thank God because God was the one behind all that was going on in the development of their church. If it's not about leaders, don't make much of one good leader. Don't make more of one good leader than you do another. Make much of Jesus Christ, not as much as whoever it is, R.C. Sproul or Doug Wilson or whoever your favorite teacher is. Another thing, we should make much of Jesus and let his name be the one that we're extolling when we talk to other people. Another application of this is that we must be careful not to get engrossed in interpersonal conflicts between leaders. It's not some sort of a perverse sport to watch Christian leaders duke it out with each other. Don't get engrossed in those things. Our focus needs to be on Christ rather than on the Christian leaders. It's not about leaders. Second point is, it is about God. Verses 6 through 9 speak of this focus on God being the focus. And two distinct roles emerge here in verse 6 and are discussed in the following verses. Two distinct roles in carrying out God's purpose. The first role that comes out is the role of church planter. You see that in verse 6. This would be analogous to the evangelist or the apostle, which are mentioned in Ephesians 4:11, where there's also a list of roles. We might say in modern usage, this is the missionary. This was Paul's role, the role of the planter, the evangelist, the missionary. Paul said, I planted, I laid a foundation. In the parable of the sower in Luke 8, Jesus said, the seed is the word. Paul's saying he planted, he's not planting a garden, he's planting a church by dropping the seed. The seed is the word of God, the gospel which is preached, explaining who Jesus is and what he has done to save us. That's what planting means. the work of an evangelist involves traveling into uncharted territory, meeting new people, sharing the gospel with strangers, and seeing the first people come to faith, laying the foundation upon which everything else will grow. Often the people who are good evangelists, good at startups, are not real good at continuing the management of the project. Often church planters don't make great church pastors. They're two different roles. But the church planters, the evangelists, the frontier people are necessary. They're very important. They bring the gospel to new people who would otherwise never hear it. The second role is that of the pastor teacher. We see in verse 6, Apollos watered. What does watered mean? It could speak of Apollos baptizing people, since apparently from the context of chapter 1, it sounds like Paul didn't baptize many people, and Apollos must have baptized more people. Apollos watered. Baptism is a symbol of organizing people into the local church, among other things. Something Paul tried to avoid for the most part. Paul said he was not into doing the baptism, into organizing the local churches so much. It could also speak of Apollos watering through the teaching of the word. Proverbs 8 speaks of the words of a man's mouth are deep waters, the fountain of wisdom is a flowing brook. Amos chapter 8 verse 11 also speaks of the word being like water. Maybe that's what it refers to, I'm not entirely sure. But I believe this is speaking of his pastoral role in nurturing and building up the church that had already been established by Paul there in Corinth. In verse 10, Paul says that another man builds upon the foundation. The Greek word for another is Apollos, which is very similar to Apollos. So I think it's possible this is a play on words here. The only record we have of Apollos' ministry is in Acts 18:27, where Luke the historian records when he came to Achaia. That's Apollos. He greatly helped those who had believed through grace. Had believed not through Paul, but through grace. For he powerfully and publicly refuted the Jews, showing by the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. Notice his ministry, the ministry of Apollos, was to help those who had already believed. That's the role of a pastor. The pastor nurtures the faith of those who believe through Bible teaching, through prayer, through living an exemplary lifestyle, through exhorting people when they are sinning, through watchful care of the flock, and through fighting against the wolves that would destroy the flock of Christ. Standing against false teachers. So there's the church planter, and then there's the pastor teacher, the evangelist, there's the pastor teacher, the waterer, and there are also many other roles in the building up of the church. As we've already seen in 1 Corinthians, Paul expects everyone to be involved in the building up of the church. It's not just the pastors and teachers. We're going to get to more of that discussion on the different parts of different roles within the church when we get to chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians. But for now, we'll just leave it that there are many other roles and that they all should be unified towards one purpose. Verse 8, Paul says, the planter and the waterer are unified. They're one. They're not to be pitted against each other. If you've got an NIV, it adds the word purpose in there, and that's fitting to the overall meaning. They're unified in their purpose because it's all about accomplishing God's will, not the purpose of a particular leader. I will read a little bit from 1 Corinthians 12, starting at verse 12. All the members of the body, being many, are one body. But now God has set each of the members in the body, even as it pleased him, so that now they are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, or again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. But God fashioned the body together, that there should be no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. If it's all about God, then we should focus in unity upon accomplishing God's plan. What is His plan? He's revealed that throughout the Scriptures over and over again. His plan is to save, redeem to Himself some from every tribe, tongue, and nation through Jesus. So if it's all about God, if Christian leadership is all about God, then we need to be unified in accomplishing God's plan rather than some human leader's plan. Secondly, if it's all about God, we should not focus honor on some people in the church, but not on other people in the church. Jesus alone should be the focus of honor. And I could spend a bunch of time on this, but I can't. But just some thoughts. How come church pastors are paid and are given a title, reverend, and deacons are not? The deacons who do the hard work of the church. How come churches carefully select and screen pastors, but often just take any warm body who wants to volunteer for Sunday school or nursery duty? How come the larger a church gets, the more you see administratively gifted people and the top leaders of echelons of leadership, and you see people with gifts of help and mercy as the peons in the leadership chain? Why is that? It shouldn't be that way. Let's be careful that the honor we accord in the church is focused by God's word rather than created by human standards. God gives the growth in the church. Colossians 2:19 speaks of the church body growing according to the growth of God. God is the one from whom growth comes. It's God who's emphasized in the grammar of the passage here in verses 7 and 9. Paul's letter was written in Greek. This letter, 1 Corinthians. Greek is a case language, which means that there are tags on each word that tell you whether it's a subject or an object or a part of a prepositional phrase or whatever. And because of these tags, you can rearrange words all over the place in a sentence in Greek. They don't have to be right next, the subject doesn't have to be right next to the verb because you've got this tag on the subject word. You can put it anywhere. And often rearranging the sentence, Paul does this in order to provide emphasis on certain words. In verse 7, the last word in the sentence is the word God. He does that to emphasize God. And in verse 9, the word God is the first word in three consecutive phrases. It's hard to translate it in English so that it shows up the same way because English doesn't have quite the same amount of case structure. But grammatically, God is emphasized here in this passage. It's all about God. It's God who gives the increase. It's from God that we are co-laborers. It is of God that you are His field. And the building we're talking about is God's. God is the focus. And if God gives the growth of the church, then there are several ramifications to that. It's God who should be honored and made important, not any human leader. We need to honor God. We kind of hit on that earlier. A second ramification is that we have to do the work of the church if we want God to increase it. It doesn't say Paul sat around and Apollos watched television, but God gave the increase. Paul planted, Apollos watered, and God gave the increase. There's human work that must be done if it is to be blessed by God. John Calvin wrote, if it were perfectly in the power of God, without the aid of men, if it so pleased Him, to produce faith in persons while asleep. But He has appointed it otherwise, so that faith is produced by hearing. That man, then, who in the neglect of this means expects to attain faith, acts just as If the husbandman, throwing aside the plow and taking no care to sow and leaving off all the labor of husbandry, were to open his mouth and expect food to drop from heaven. I love the way he writes things. Here's another ramification. If it's God who provides the increase, then we can be encouraged that our efforts will not be unfruitful. If it is God's plan to increase the church, and He calls us to do things in that process, then we can be encouraged that what we do will be blessed by God. Be encouraged. Don't give up. And a fourth ramification of this, if it's God who gives the increase, then we should be growing ourselves. We should be looking for increase, for growth. The three metaphors here in this passage, there's the child-rearing metaphor at the beginning of chapter 3. There's the field, farm-garden metaphor in verses 6 through 9. And then there's the building construction metaphor in verses 9 through 15, actually bleeding a little further down. But the goal of child-rearing, what's the goal of child-rearing? It's to produce a mature adult who can reproduce themselves. Are you able to reproduce believers? What's the goal of a field or a farm or a garden? It's to grow food, to be fruitful. Are you bearing fruit? Are you achieving that purpose for God? Are you bringing a harvest of souls for Jesus? What is the purpose of a construction project? It's to end up with a building that has walls that can guard a place of residence, keeps the rain off, keeps the wild animals out, keeps you warm. Are you guarding the gospel? Are you a fitting residence of the Holy Spirit of God? If God is about causing the growth, then these are things that we should expect to see in our own lives. So if it's not about the leaders, it is all about God. What about our role? Paul speaks to how we should be taking a lead in the church, every one of us, in verses 10 through 15. Paul starts off by setting the standard of leadership, how we should lead in the church. He says in verse 10, that he leads according to the grace of God which was given to me. That's easy to skip over, but it's important. Paul's not acting out of his own strength. He's working in dependence upon the grace of God. Furthermore, so he is leaning upon God's grace rather than upon his strength, personal strength and wisdom. Secondly, he is not doing what he wants to do, but what God wants him to do, according to the grace of God which was given to me. Paul's not baptizing people. Not many, anyway. He's not leading music. He's not starting a body piercing shop. He was commissioned to be a church planter, and so that's what he's doing. That's the grace that was given to him, so he's going to do that thing, and not something else that he wasn't called or gifted to do. Likewise, we need to identify what God has called and gifted us to do and seek to become channels of His strength and grace as we do that thing that He's made us for. Verse 10 also, Paul says that he was a wise master builder. The Greek word there is architect, literally. It's the only place this word appears in the New Testament. In classical Greek literature, the architect, this person, would be a man in a construction project who has the overall plan in mind and who takes the lead in building with the stones and the wood. So he's not so much in the ivory tower drawing blueprints, although he does have master idea in his mind. He's kind of a combination of architect and general contractor and foreman and laborer, doing it all but taking the lead in that. which is the concept that's brought out in our English translations, master, having more to do with, you know, the skill as well as the leadership of the other workers. The great cathedrals that were built in the ancient times, in medieval times, they took several generations to build. You'd have one master builder who would build a level and dies unable to complete the building in his lifetime, so another one comes in, gets the feel for how the building is being constructed and what's going to be appropriate to go to the next level on that cathedral, and he spends his lifetime building the next level. He dies, and another one comes in, and he's looking at the big picture of what's been done. He adds on to that. That's a good picture of what we as the church should do as we approach this project that God has of drawing people from every tongue and tribe and nation into fellowship with Him and redeeming them. We can step back and look at that big picture, figure out what's appropriate and how God has gifted and called us, and then we step in and take our place in that project. Paul says that he laid a foundation, which he says is Jesus Christ in verse 11. This foundation laying of Jesus Christ refers to his preaching of Jesus Christ crucified, like he said in the last chapter, two chapters ago. Gordon Clark rightly connects this verse, I believe, with Matthew 16:18. Upon this rock I will build my church. What was that rock? It was the rock solid confession of Peter. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Based upon that kind of faith, the church can grow. Therefore, we should not try to build upon another foundation besides Jesus. Everything we do in the church needs to flow out of His Word rather than out of our culture's expectations. A golden castle that's built on sand is no good. It needs to be on the right foundation. Paul exhorts us in verse 10 that we should look to or take heed or be careful how we build the church. We need to build with the appropriate materials. Verse 12 mentions several building materials, wood, hay, straw, as well as gold, silver, precious stones. I've even seen houses made with car tires. They all work as building materials. The structure that we raise, however, must answer to the foundation. If the foundation is Christ, what is going to be consistent with Christ, with His character, with His teaching, with His Word as we build? Good building materials are those people or ideas which are rooted in Christ Jesus. Bad building materials are those which are rooted in merely human ideas. That's why we must carefully evaluate everything that we do in the church. Our strategies, our resources, the programs, Bible studies, evangelism methods, liturgy, to see is this according to the foundation of Christ in the Bible, what he teaches in His Word, or is this some other idea? Is it some composite of other people's ideas which are not entirely solidly based on the foundation? An example of ideas which are not solidly an idea which to us may be obviously off base is praying to saints. Now, we believe in prayer. God, Jesus commanded us to pray, right? So we should pray. We also believe in life after death. The Bible teaches us that. That's orthodox. After people die, they're continuing to live and be somehow able to exist as persons. And so, since if people who have died on earth are currently living in heaven, then surely they can observe us here on earth, maybe. And since they are in heaven, surely they would have some better idea even than we do on earth how to present things to God, because they're right there with Him, right? Maybe. And so we should pray to saints too, right? No. That's moving off the foundation. That's not something the Bible teaches us to do. It's based on human ideas, and those human ideas, while plausible, have distracted Roman Catholic Christians for hundreds of years. They have to figure out, okay, now which saint might be more sympathetic to a toothache? And I'll pray to that one. And well, but if you have a headache, you've got to figure out some other saint that might be more sympathetic to headaches, and then they'll. So you pray to this, and it's a huge amount of time and effort that's spent on something the Bible tells us nothing about. It's a distraction. It's a moving off of the foundation of Christ. Building on man-made ideas is building with straw that slips off the foundation and leaves the church in a precarious condition. The main difference between the building materials appears to be between the first three and the latter three in verse 12. The first three will not go up in smoke if they're burned. The latter three will. Paul exhorts us that we should watch out how we build the church, because God will judge our work in verse 13. He says there's going to come a day when God destroys the earth by fire. And this fire will be the ultimate test of what sort or quality our work was. Peter talks about this in his second letter, chapter 3, verse 10. The day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will be dissolved with a fervent heat, and the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. There are other passages that mention this as well, especially Malachi 4:1 and Matthew 3:12. There are two possibilities that we can live our lives for. We can live our lives for the judgment of men, to be acceptable to people, or we can live our lives to be prepared for the judgment of God, when the earth and all its works will be burned up. Which judgment are you living for? Human approval is worthless. Don't strive for it. John Calvin wrote, however men may look upon themselves as forming acute judgments, their discernment, notwithstanding, reaches no further than appearance, which, for the most part, has no solidity. These are fools who depend upon man's estimation so as to reckon it enough to be approved by men. Doctrines fly about like empty bubbles that glitter for a moment until they've come to be thoroughly tested. Hence it follows that we must reckon as nothing all the applause of the world, the emptiness of which will in a very little be exposed by heaven's judgment. What are you investing your life in? Are you investing your life in things that will survive that final fire, the judgment of God? It's kind of scary for me to think that as much time as I've poured into renovating my house and creating and uploading web pages, making music recordings, all my books, all my tools, my cars, my kitchen utensils, my food, clothes, my garden, all that is going to evaporate. There's going to be nothing left of those things in God's judgment by fire. The only thing I can take to heaven with me is human souls. That is what we should be investing our lives in. Human souls are the only thing that are going to survive that final fire of testing. Does this mean that we should abandon all of the material things in the world? I don't believe so. We need to keep a tension between the extremes of materialism and spiritualism. Both are an extreme that are wrong-headed. God has given us the dominion mandate from Genesis God said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven, over everything that moves, living thing that lives on the face of the earth. The material world is something that we need to be working and exercising dominion over. God, Jesus also gave us the gospel mandate. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. There is a spiritual mandate as well as a physical one for the followers of God. So we must do both. We must work like our children will inherit this earth, but we must strategically invest in the spiritual lives of people so that if Jesus comes back in our lifetime, we will be able to bring along many faithful followers of Christ with us. We've got to do both. Don't ignore the material world. Jesus said to use the material world as a means for influencing more people's lives. Luke 16:9. Make for yourselves friends by means of worldly wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Paul teaches that we will receive a reward according to our labor. And I don't feel like I have time to go into the biblical doctrine of what of the reward. Maybe we can get into that later, or you can look up the sermon on the website and it'll be there. But just the points without the proofs. This reward comes when the dead are judged. Revelation 11:18. This reward comes in heaven. Matthew 5:12. The reward is the opposite of getting praise from men. The reward is to be appreciated by God. That's Matthew 6. Part of the reward is to even be able to enter heaven. There will be those who have wasted their life foolishly on the things of this world, even though they believe in Jesus. And those people will suffer loss. All their books and cars and everything, that's going to evaporate, and there'll be nothing else to show for their life. They'll suffer loss. The loss of their worldly prizes, but they themselves will be saved because salvation is not by works, but by faith in Jesus. But we don't want to be someone in that category. Don't be someone who's in that category. When David Livingstone went back to when David Livingstone, the missionary to Africa, died after a lifetime of proclaiming Christ in Africa, he was very famous throughout the English-speaking world. His countrymen back in England wanted his body returned for burial in Westminster Abbey, London, and that's where it is today. We're told that when the ship carrying his body pulled alongside the quayside in England, a great crowd gathered there at the quay to honor the memory of this great missionary, David Livingstone. As his body was being carried onto the dock, there was an old man in the crowd who kept saying over and over, "I've lived my life for the wrong world. I've lived my life for the wrong world." He kept saying that, and someone standing next to him later asked him, "What did you mean by that?" He said that he had been a boyhood friend of David Livingstone, growing up in school with him. And when David Livingstone announced that he was going to go to Africa to become a missionary, he had told David at that time, "David, you're being a fool. I'm going to stay right here and make something in my life." And now, at the end of his life, he realized David Livingstone did what was important. He built with gold and silver and precious stones. And this man had nothing to show for how he had spent his life. He had spent it on the wood, hay, and stubble. Don't live your life for the wrong world. Step into the church construction zone and fulfill God's promises. He will save the world according to the grace that He has given you.